Okay. Can we start? I've got a couple more lectures to go on finite state machines. And this lecture, I want to talk to you a little bit about the limitations of finite state machines and a little bit. And also at the end, I'm going to say a little bit about one way of overcoming some of those limitations, which is to do with grammars. So what will happen is we'll say a little bit about the limitations, and I'll give you a proof associated with that. And then we'll start talking about how grammars link in to those sorts of things. And then on the Friday lecture, then I'll be talking a little bit about how finite state machines link into probabilistic systems, and probabilistic finite state machines of different kinds. So that's the deal for this week. Okay, so palindromes. This is the standard example that that people use to talk about limitations of finite state machines. So I guess you know what a palindrome is. If you don't, you're going to know pretty soon. So these words are palindromes. They're ones that read the same forwards or backwards. EYE or EYE, left or right, it's just the same. So words that are balanced in that way. So suppose we have an alphabet just has A and B in it. So then, and we ask, what are the palindromes that are allowed by that alphabet? Well, A is, B is, so is AA, so is BB, ABA, all sorts of fancy things where the A's and the B's are balanced. Right? So those would be all. You could imagine all of the palindromes that you could construct using A's and B's, using that alphabet. So there's infinitely many of those that you could build. And there's the theorem. So there's no finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes over the alphabet AB. So palindromes over alphabet of two characters are examples of systems where you can't build a finite state machine to accept them, and I'm going to explain to you why. Okay, so here's the proof of that. It's kind of interesting. There's a number of reasons for giving you this example. One is just to give you an example of a kind of stereotypical kind of case where you can't use a finite state machine to actually solve the problem of being able to say, is there an acceptor for this language or not, to show that such a thing exists. So that's one point. But another point is just to give you an idea that when you're looking at these things, then one of the values of these kinds of systems is that you can ask questions about what they can and they can't do, which is much easier to do with these formal systems than it is to do with some kind of less precisely defined natural system. So you've asked, what is it that the economy can or cannot do? There really isn't much of an answer to that question because we don't have a grip on what that is. But with these systems, we do, and at a very abstract level where we aren't really even concerned about what the machine is, we're just concerned about its functionality. Okay, so this tells you a lot about classes of machines. Okay, so here's the theorem. There's no finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes over alphabet AB. That's going to hold if we can show that it's contradictory to believe that there is a finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes over that alphabet. Right, so the proof that we're going to do, remember proof by contradiction from when we were doing logic? It's one of those again. Okay, so we're going to show that it's ridiculous to believe that there exists one. And I'm going to need an assumption which I'm not going to prove for you, but you'll be doing stuff connected with this in the tutorials. So any finite state machine you can represent as a deterministic finite state machine. Even your non-deterministic ones, if you want, if you take the trouble and build a big enough machine, you can build a deterministic one from it. Okay, so then we'll turn this into a deterministic finite state machine problem, and what we're going to show is that it's contradictory to believe that there exists a deterministic finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes. Now, if that's contradictory, then we know that there's no finite state machine that can recognize that language of palindromes. Okay. So here's how it goes. So it's a finite state machine, so there's going to be some finite number of states. Right? That's part of the definition of a finite state machine. Let's call it K. It doesn't matter what the number is, but we just call it K. And let's also suppose that we have a palindrome that's got KAs and then KBs and then KAs. So however many those are, right? And we're allowed to have a palindrome like that. That palindrome could exist. So here it is. Here's just a schematic for it. So for any trace, it's going to look like this. There's going to be some initial state, and then we'll go through the A's, and then we're going to get the B's, and then the A's. And we're going to be chewing up K-steps for the A's, transitions, and K-steps for the B's, and then K-steps for the rest of the A's. Right, that's what the trace will have to look like. It's not the that's not the finite state machine, that's the trace through the finite state machine. Right. Because that's the only way we can get a trace, is by stepping through the states. So that's going to be k plus 1 states for the first set of these A's, right? Because we have one more state for the steps, right? We have a state for one step, we have two states, right? So that's added the extra state, and so that's k plus 1. Okay, so if that's true, and we have k states in our finite state machine, and we need k plus 1 states to do the first bit of the A's, right? Then there's got to be a loop in the finite state machine, right? Important that's the most important thing that I just told you there, right? Happy with that? People go, ooh. Right, so we're saying we have a finite state machine with k states. We're going to give it a palindrome with KAs, KBs, and KAs again. Then there has to be a loop in that first set of A's, because we only got K states. And we know for the trace, just to get through the first lot of A's, we need K plus 1. So the only way that could have happened would have been that there's a loop, because we can't invent another one state. So it must have gone through the same state once. There must have been a loop. It must have gone back to a state. Otherwise, we could not possibly have got the trace with k plus 1 states. Right? Happy with that. So I'm laboring this point. But it's the bit that the whole of the rest of this hinges on. Happy with that? K state is all you've got to play with. Give it a palindrome with KAs, KBs, and KAs in it. There must have been a loop there somewhere, because you only had k states to play with, and your trace went for longer than that. Right. Okay, so then we know something about what this looks like. So here's what's going to go on. We have to go through that. So now we have a loop, and we must have an I that's smaller than the k that was the bit that we went to before we got the loop, right? So we must have had some number of A's that we went through, and then we had a loop with some number of A's going through, and then we went on and did the rest, and we went and got to the acceptor state, right? So we have some bit before the loop, and then we hit the loop, and then we go through. Right? That has to be true, otherwise we couldn't have got the trace out. So that means that we read A, K minus I, BK, and then AK takes us to an accept state. Right? So taking out the loop. Right? There's the important bit is this is a shorter bit, and then some of this goes through to get to the accept state. Right. So then here's the bit that kills it. Right. So we've got, just to recap again, we have our finite state machine that's got going through the A's, we've got the first lot of A's, we've got a loop, and then something else happens with the B's and the A's that makes sense. And we need it to have that finite state machine in order to recognize it with KAs, KBs, and KAs again. That was the finite state machine that we needed to build to recognize that particular, to give us that trace. Then the trouble is, we can invent this, we can give it another sequence. And this sequence is definitely not a palindrome. Okay, so we give this A, K plus I, and BK, AK. Okay, so that's going to get, and that's not a palindrome, right? Because it's got a different, it's unbalanced, it's got different number of A's here. So it's going to read I A's to get to this state where there's the loop, and that's going to leave that. Okay, and then you do a loop at K, reading whatever that is, and that leaves us with this guy. But the trouble is that A, K minus I, BK, will take us to an accept state. So what we're doing here is, so you have something where you have, to do it a little less formally, you have something where you've got this, a loop, and then the rest of it to your accept state. Right? And you constructed this loop just so that you could cope with the palindrome. Right? So this plus this is meant to be accounting for the fact that you didn't have enough states to go through the first lot of A's. But the trouble is, if you give it something that's going to effectively jump through that, it can't recognize whether it's been through that or not. Right? Because it's not got any memory. It can't say, oh, well, I went through that bit and I didn't go through some other bit. Right? Okay, long silence. If you find that hard to think through in detail, you just go back through and work it out in detail, and it does work through. Okay. So, what we have is a finite state machine that will accept AK, BK, AK, but because it had to have this loop in it in order to do so, then it will incorrectly accept this unbalanced one, AK plus I, BK, AK, for some I. And that I is the bit that's you've taken up with the, it's the bit that you've taken up leading into the loop. So if that's true, if you can find an instance such that that is true, then the thing that will correctly detect palindromes is also has flaws in it. It will allow you to incorrectly accept things that are not palindromes, because of the structure that you had to build into the finite state machine. So since that's true, then it is contradictory to believe that there's a deterministic finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes, because I just showed you one where it won't and where you can't build the machine. So if that's true, there's no finite state machine that can recognize the language of palindromes. Doesn't mean you couldn't have one that recognized some palindromes, but would recognize precisely the language of palindromes without any ones that weren't. Right. Happy about that. Okay, so the good news is I'm not going to ask you to do that proof in the exam or anything like that. So the reason for giving you the proof is to show you, just to give you a kind of feeling for how you can reason in the abstract sense about classes of these finite state machines. It's nice that you would see that. Actually, in second year, you'll see a little bit more of these kinds of things, talking about other aspects of those kinds of proofs. But for now, that's all you see. But there is a kind of rule of thumb. So here's the rule of thumb that it is worth remembering, actually. If you need to do things like count up to arbitrary high values, things like that, then you ain't going to be able to do it with a finite state machine because it doesn't have any memory. Right, so a palindrome is an example of that, because what it's really trying to do is you're saying, well, the number of A's that we get at the beginning is going to be the same as the number of A's at the end, and so on for any other characters that you were balancing up. And what you really want for that is a machine that can count through the number of A's in the first bit and remember what that number is, and then go in and count through the number on the other side. So you have to have some kind of device that will do that. And the trouble with your finite state machine is that all it can remember is, well, it doesn't have any memory, it's just structurally, it's where you happen to be in that network is the best thing that you can do for memory. It has no notion of context that can kind of move between the nodes, no memory that you can pass around. You need a more complicated machine if you're going to do that. And of course, plenty of notations exist that are extensions of finite state machine notations that look like finite state machines almost, except they have extra annotations to allow you to reason about that. And then you might be asking yourself the question, why aren't we using those here? Well, two reasons. One is that they're harder to talk about in introductory lectures like this. And the other reason is that then there are certain things that you can't do. You know, reason about what it is, what you can reach, what you can't reach, because they're more complicated structures to reason about. A bit like in logics. I can make my logics more complicated, but then I have issues to do with decidability and so on of those logics. So there's always a tension in these things. Yeah, question?
Technically, can't know computer without the arbitrarily high values, since you have memory, and when you have the infinitely large numbers, it will store arbitrarily high values.
It could, but oh, could it count to an arbitrarily high value? You mean if you said if you said is your question simply if you give a computer the task of counting to infinity and said, name me the numbers, could it do it? No. That isn't is, I, what I don't mean is infinitely high. What I mean is is where I say, like in a palindrome, I want to be able to balance these k's, but I won't tell you what the k is. If I said I want to construct a finite state machine that will count all the palindromes where we can have no more than, I don't know, 10 a's or something, I can build it because I bound it the value, and I could construct, as many finite state machines as I need it to do it for 1, for 2, for 3, for 4, for 5, for 6. I could build the structure of the finite state machine. But when it's k, so it's arbitrarily high, I don't tell you what k is. All I'm telling you here is that this number and this number and this number is the same number, right? Then I'm not going to be able to do that because I can't construct the structure for it. But I can, well, I'll show you actually something that can do it. Correct. Then I can build a finite state machine.
Well, then don't all k's essentially have a limitation then? Because
No, I can. So for palindromes, it's easy. Let me show you. Right. Here's a context-free grammar. Context-free grammars can do palindromes, and we can implement context-free grammars. I'll show you how to do it in the next slide in logic. This actually is nicely into the next bit, actually. So just because finite state machines can't do it doesn't mean that you can't do it. So context-free grammar is an example of something that does allow you to deal with palindromes. This I'm not going to show you how to implement, but I will show you how to implement a variant of this in the next slide. But first thing you need just is to see the grammar. So these guys are not finite state machines. In some ways they look simpler, and in some ways they're edging a little bit closer to logic, which I'll show you in a moment. Don't ask me yet, but I'll show you in the next slide. So context-free grammar is just a set of rules. And the way that you read them is you start with an initial start symbol, and then you build. So here's one for palindrome. This says a valid palindrome sentence S, it can be S with A on each side. You can build it that way. So you can take whatever S is, put to it an A on each side, it's a palindrome, where S is a palindrome, right? So this is kind of, it's good. In some ways, it's good old-fashioned recursion we're looking at here. So here's a palindrome, take a palindrome, put two A's on the side, it's still a palindrome. Here's a palindrome, put two B's on the side, it's still a palindrome. And this guy says, the empty string is a palindrome, so is A, and so is B. Right? And then, here's how it works. If I give it the palindrome AABABAA, then the issue is, can I apply these rules to generate this? And yes, I can. So if I take the rules here, then using 3, I can get A, right? There says S gives me A. Using A and 2, I can get BAB, right? Using this and 1, I can get ABA, and then applying 1 again, I get this, which is what I was looking for. So that's a different notation that clearly can deal with palindromes and can deal with them of any size, because what we're doing here, because the notation itself naturally does the balancing for us. The memory is somehow built into the rules, as it were. Okay, so onto the rest of this question. Suppose you wanted to implement something that would do that. I'm glad I put in this slide. It's not in your notes. I put it in because I thought I would have a bit of time, and it was nice to link back into the logic stuff. So here's the link back to the logic stuff. Suppose you wanted to implement this in logic. You're not going to get this in an exam. Relax. I've got 20 minutes or so, I'm just going to spend it talking to you about doing this, because it's good for you to see how to do this. And the other nice thing is it closes it back into the logic now from the finite state machine side. Okay, so these are your rules. You know what these rules are for the context-free grammar. Here's a bit of a logic. There's probably not time. I was going to explain how this links into definite clause grammars, which you are actually a programming tool, but I'll maybe not have time for that. Let me just stick with the logic for now, which is more or less the same thing. So suppose you want to be able to build something that would allow you to apply a theorem prover, something that would do a proof, in order to actually test whether those rules hold or not. You want a set of axioms which you could use for doing this. I've built this set of axioms so they look almost exactly like Horn clauses. So with these guys, unless I made a typo or something, you can compute. You can give it to a logic program to a language like Prolog, and it will give you the answer. Right? So these are definitely computable. I need to give you a couple of tricks in order for you to understand this. So let me just do them on the board. Right. So here's the. You need to know two tricks. And you'll notice these letters in uppercase are variables. So we're straying away from the straight and narrow path of propositional logic. Now we've got a logic with variables in it. Too bad. Sometimes it's good for you to see variables. So two tricks. One is that thing. See the number four that's stuck down at the end there. That's a funny looking axiom. Because it's this funny C thing. It doesn't matter that it's called C. I could have called it anything at all. I called it C because it kind of sounds like concatenate, although it's not quite that. So what C does is if I say C with some list, I don't know, A, B, A, doesn't really matter, then it will give me A, and then it will give me B, A. So that's true for C, right? Because that bar there is the thing that separates out the first element of the list, just like we were talking about in earlier lectures, right? So, or to be more precise, C, A, bar, and then the remainder of the list, B, A. Right? That's the X. That's the R. X, R. Right? Happy about that. So that's think of the C thing as being something that you can give it a list, and you give it a list, like that, sequence. It gives you the first element of the sequence and spits out the remainder of the sequence. So it's very convenient. It just nips off the first element of the list. Boop, off it comes. How's that? Good? That's the first little trick you need to know. And the second little trick you need to know is this bit where you've got the I and the R up there, where you have pairs of arguments. So I have S, I, R, if C, I, A, R1, and S, R1, R2, and C, R2, A, R. What's really going on here is you have to watch where the variables are. So think of this as being the sequence that you're processing, right? So it's your palindrome or whatever. It'll be as big as you like. We don't care. This is the funny one. This is whatever is left over when you're finished processing, which typically you'll want to be empty, right? So if I'm doing a palindrome and I could say A, B, A. If that whole thing really is a palindrome, that one there, then what's left over is nothing at all. I could also say could I process one of the things, and what would be left over after I'd taken out the palindrome? So if I was to say, for this, give me A, B, A, B, could there be, what could R be? Then R could be B, yeah. And the first bit would have been a palindrome. Nope, B. Actually, no, because it's chewing them off from the front. It's just B. Yeah, but good question, but no, it doesn't do it the other way. It's because it's always working from the front. Okay. So this is kind of neat. This is the trick by which people who are doing logic who want to implement things like context-free grammars or loads of other kinds of grammars. There's whole families of grammars you can implement. This is the basic trick that people often do. So you add in these two arguments to your logic. This is going to be what's left over. And the reason this is so useful is because you can then split it up into chunks. So this bit pulls off the A, right? And this is the bit that's left over. So if it was ABA, that would be A, and that would be BA, right? And then that bit is the same as that guy. So it's just like feeding it in as an input. If this was a functional language, this would be like feeding it in as the input to your function. Right? And so then this is what's left over here. So if that was ABA, then that would be ABA, and this would be BA. And so is that, because they're the same. And then this is going to be whatever it is. Let's imagine that it's B or something, because that's probably what it would be, actually. B. It would be A. Because this would do whatever it is. It would chew off the B and leave you with A. And then this would take, so this is now the same as this. And this will take out that's A, and that's an empty list. And this guy, is the same as that guy. Right? So if all of this goes through, I'll step you through one in a moment, just as a kind of finale. But if all of this goes through, then what you're really doing is you're saying, I have, according to whatever is my context-free grammar, let's call it S, because that's what that's called, then I've got some sequence, I've got some remainder, and let's say it's ABA I'm dealing with. I chew off the A from here, and that's going to leave BA, which is, and then I have, this has to be correct according to S, and I chew off whatever I need from that. I'm left with, let's say, A in this particular case. Actually, I can show you how that's done if you want. I'll step you through an example, actually, on the slides. Then that goes in here, it's A, chew off the A, and I'm left with nothing. This nothing is the same as here, and so then the answer for this is nothing. And so that means that is a palindrome, because I've used all the symbols and I've satisfied S. Right? Happy about? Well, it's not like you're going to go away and start writing the axioms and so on, but you get the kind of general drift. It's just a standard trick that people do to push these things into logic. So let me step you through one. Here's the complete proof tree for doing S for AABABAA, right? So you say, can I satisfy, so this is giving you with all the variables filled in, right? So this goes through with nothing left over, the empty sequence. Why? Because I can use that rule, number one, here. I chew off the first element, A, right? It's the first element. And I'm left with the remainder, A, B, A, B, A, A, right? That's what C does. And now I have to be able to satisfy this guy, which is smaller, right? A, B, A, B, A, A. Right. And then if that's satisfied, which it will be, I'll show you, then I need to be able to show that whatever's left over, it turns out to be A, satisfies C for A and leaves me nothing, right, which it does. So then I want to be able to satisfy A, B, A, A, A. To do that, I use first one again. C for this, choose off the A, leaves me with B, A, B, A, A. And then I want to be able to satisfy S for B, A, B, A, A, the remainder, to give me whatever's left over. It's going to be A, A. And then from that, I have to be able to take A off and leaves me with A. That's what this is, right? And then for this one, I use number 2. So then B has to be to satisfy C with the remainder here, A, B, A, A. This has to be true for A, B, A, A with some remainder. And then for the remainder, I use the C, 2 off the B, leaves A, 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 which is what's here. And then for this guy, I have to say, is S true for A, B, A, A? And that's true using number 4 for C of A, leaving B, A, A, right? And then that's what's here. I don't think any of you really got that. I tried, but I failed. What's the best way to do it? Let me do it this way. I could just let you off the hook, but I'm not going to. I'm going to have another go because I think you're so close to really getting it that it would be nice that you really got it. You don't need it for an exam, but I'd like you to get it. Yeah, let me step through it again. I think it'll make it clear. Rather than answer that specific question, because I think it'll be easier if I just walk through it. Let's do a simpler one. So if I say, give me S of A, B, A. How about that one? Right. Let's do that one. So I want to do, maybe a little lower. I want to say, is ABA a palindrome? And the way I express that is I say, does S hold for ABA with nothing left over in the sequence? Right? That's how I express it. Happy with that? That's how I do the query. So can I satisfy that? And if I can, it's a palindrome. Okay. So then I have to choose how to do it. And the way I'm doing it is I'm saying, how can I conclude that? I can conclude that if any of these ones are satisfied, right? Because those are giving me the conditions on which S would be true. So this is a good one to choose, right? Just intuitive. I have a choice. It's non-deterministic in that sense. I could choose any one of those axioms to be able to satisfy this. But of course, I have to make the right choice. I'm the human theorem prover doing this, right? Turns out there's a mechanical theorem prover called Prolog that can do it too. Okay, so if I choose 1, then here's what I have. This tells me what I have to do. I have to do C for I, A, and R1. So I have to do this. I have to satisfy this. C for, now what's I? I is A, B, A, right? And that's A, and I get R1, right? That's the first thing I need to do. Then I also need to do this. I also need to get S for R1, R2. And I also need to do this. Mm-hmm. R2, A. And this is empty list, right? Because that R there is the same as the R at the beginning, which is an empty list, right? So this has to be an empty list. Right? Happy with that? So now I'm gonna do this guy. So does this work? Yes, it does. Because with this one, C of X, these two X's have to be the same, and these two have to be the same. So I get C of A bar B A. A, and this is B A, right? Yeah. So then this guy here, if I could actually use this properly, so that means that this is the same as this. So this has to be BA, right? Yep. So that's the same as this. So this is BA. BA. Oops. Right? Good. So far, so good. With me, everybody with me so far. I almost feel like I'm the automated theorem prover doing this. This is exactly what happens. So here we go. So now I need to do this one. And so then I have to decide how to do this. I've got BA. And so I'm going to choose the one with the B in it. Is that the right thing to do? Yeah. So I choose the one with the B in it. Oh, no, I don't. B. Oh, no, I just need the C for this, don't I? Yes, I just need the C for this one. So I can do this. So I need number 3. This is number 3. Okay, so this says SIR if C. This is an OR, right? So I can choose either one of the ORs. I choose this one. I choose that one. C, B, A, B, R2. So then R2 is going to be A, right? Happy with that? So that means that this R2 is A. Right. And that means that this R2 is A. And bingo. Because that's, I know that C, I'll write this out in full just for to be sure. A bar empty sequence. A. Empty sequence. And that's the, for that simple example, obviously I don't want to do very complicated examples because I'm forever on the board writing stuff in chalk then. But for that simple example, you can see how it goes through, right? And if it was a bigger example, all that I would have would be more of this kind of jazz of, you know, pulling this stuff apart. It would just be bigger. It wouldn't be really any different. And that's the way that works. So, that's it done. Questions, of course, yes.
So we use for R2, we use C serial as well, yeah?
R2.
Where you've got S, B, A, comma, A.
Yep.
Yeah, so for R2, we use rule C as well.
Yeah, so that's what this rule allows you to do. So really what this is saying, you can look right across here and it more or less gives you the correspondence. So what this one is doing is where you got, what this one said, you have to have an A and then whatever happens and then an A. So this one is saying the same. This gives you an A and whatever happens and an A. This one is doing a B and whatever happens and then a B. This one says it can be either nothing or an A or a B. And so this one says C, nothing, A, or a B. And this one is giving you this one is doing the bit that says it appears in the sequence. I have to have an extra axiom that actually pulls the symbol out of the sequence. Because that's kind of hidden conveniently when you're just describing the context-free grammar rules. When I'm describing the whole thing in logic, it can't be hidden, it has to be there, it has to be an axiom. Okay? So it doesn't matter, if you didn't understand the last 20 minutes or so completely, it's not going to make a big difference to your life, really. If you did, then you understand something more that you didn't really need for the course and gives you a little bit of an insight into what the link is between logic and the finite state machines, which is good for you. And there was one other question. I don't know if I... Woof. I don't know. Actually, nobody knows. As far as I'm aware, nobody knows. It's one of these things. I don't know if you want. So, you look to me like the sort of person who's been reading about Gödel's theorem and all of those kinds of things. And if you are the sort of person who's been reading about Gödel's theorem and all those sorts of things, then you can get quite a lot of enjoyment and interest out of trying to understand what might be the ultimate limitation of all of this. And I was thinking about last year and the year before, I gave a little lecture about all of these kinds of things and how they kind of link up. I'm not sure whether I'm going to do it this year or not. Depends on how I pull it in. But in case I don't, what this really comes down to, your question is, let's just take maths is a good example, because it's nice and contained, and mathematics is mathematics. Could we build a computer that could prove every theorem that could ever be proved in mathematics? Is that possible? And there are people, of course, historically, who have tried to answer that question. Could I write a set of axioms, not necessarily in that language, but a set of axioms like those, huge big set, that would be capable in principle of axiomatizing all of mathematics? And the answer is believed to be no. But it's quite difficult to know whether the assumptions on which those conclusions are reached are necessarily true. And I wouldn't presume to be able to give the answer to that. If you put a gun to my head, I'd say no. On the assumption that would maybe stop me being shot or something. But it wouldn't be an answer that I sort of that I can justify, and I think it's proved to be quite a difficult one to justify. What you can say is people who have tried have failed, and people who have tried to reason the converse have typically won the argument. But that doesn't mean, of course, that the other thing. Since I come from an AI background, sorry, this is keeping you in for a bit, but I got time. Since I come from an AI background, of course, this argument used to rage quite a lot about 20 years ago. I'm that old, I can remember these things, about AI, about building things that would be very intelligent. Same arguments were trotted out. Could you build a computer that would be that clever because it would be almost like axiomatized in mathematics, and so it would be that complex? And it turns out to be much more slippery than that. So even if you believe, as I do, that axiomatizing all of maths would be, you know, certainly impractical, possibly impossible, I don't know. But even if you believe that, that doesn't tell you anything at all about machines that you can actually practically build. Because they don't sit, they're not abstract. You know, every robot you build interacts with the environment. So it's not, a lot of these things are not built, they're embedded. And almost every system that we build is embedded. It actually drives a lot of what it does and derives a lot of its power from what it does with you, not from what it does itself. So it's almost impossible to have a completely abstract argument about it, because you're actually part of the thing that you're trying to axiomatize and have a go axiomatizing that. So that do for now. Can I let you go? Out you go. I'll see you tomorrow.